Distinguished Vice Rector, dear colleagues, dear members of the audience. It is a pleasure and an honor to be here before you today and be given this opportunity to present my research. In this presentation, I will talk about the role of language in the legal process. More specifically, I will try to explain how a linguist, in my case, a linguistic anthropologist with a background in interaction analysis, can help shed light on the process of criminal adjudication. And as you will have guessed from my title, I am not interested in just any form of criminal adjudication, but specifically in the way in which the International Criminal Court administers justice for international crimes like mass atrocities or genocide. Allow me to start with a confession. It is purely coincidental that I ended up researching language in the courtroom. As a fresh postdoc, I knew a thing or two about face-to-face interaction and about situated language use in African societies. And therefore, I was hired on a project that would examine intercultural communication in Belgian courtrooms. Belgium being the country where I was born and where I was living and working at the time. Unfortunately, none of us had ever set foot in a courtroom before. And we quickly learned that in Belgian courtrooms, in Belgian criminal proceedings, it is magistrates and lawyers who are in charge of interaction at the hearing. There is surprisingly little direct communication between legal professionals and the lay defendants and lay witnesses who appear before them, let alone the complex intercultural encounters that we had in mind when we drafted the proposal. So, in that sense, our project ran into unexpected problems. Still, the experience of going to court and doing fieldwork there had triggered something. From then on, the law had its hold on me. Now, when you think about it, it is of course no surprise that a linguistic anthropologist gets carried away by the process of criminal adjudication. After all, the law is just saturated with language. The criminal code is expressed in language, and so are judgments and verdicts. Overall, lawyers and attorneys are well aware of the power of interpretation, and they know better than anyone else that minor nuances in linguistic meaning may have major legal consequences. Language becomes even more prominent, however, once we extend our view beyond the finished products of legal proceedings and also take into consideration process and performance. Once we also start paying attention to that what is said and done in the interactional arena of the courtroom. The competing narratives of the facts of the case and how these narratives either implicate or alleviate guilt. The linguistic practices by which trial participants establish intertextual connections with written documents. The way in which oral statements are first put into writing and then reenacted at a later trial stage. The implicit understandings of meaning and of text that inform these various practices. All this is, for obvious reasons, low-hanging fruit for a linguist interested in the social life of language and in the real-world consequences of language use. But why did I decide to investigate these issues in the context of the International Criminal Court? Well, at this point, a second confession is in order. I ended up researching the ICC purely by accident. Around a decade ago or so, when I worked at Ghent University, that is still back in Belgium, across the hall there was a historian who specialized in the political history of Mali, a country in West Africa where a civil war had just broken out at that time. One day he came up to me and said, you and I should talk, to which he luckily immediately added, don't worry, it's content. So over a beer, he set out an ambitious plan to monitor the various reconciliation initiatives and transitional justice mechanisms that were about to start, which we would observe on the fly, that is, while the conflict was still underway. And one of these mechanisms was the international... Okay. Sorry, I may accidentally have passed on the wrong... the wrong slideshow. Don't worry, I had only one slide, a slide with a picture of the ICC, so I'll be able to manage these presentations without slides. Something was supposed to go wrong, so this is it. One of these mechanisms was the International Criminal Court, a permanent tribunal, a permanent international tribunal located in The Hague, the Netherlands, that had become operative in 2002 and that has the authority to prosecute individuals accused of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and the crimes of genocide and aggression. So in the months that followed, my colleague and I assembled an interdisciplinary team, and together we submitted a series of project proposals that almost got funded, but in the end never made it to the finish line. After a few attempts, the others gave up, but at least I had found a new career goal, investigating the role that language and discourse play in criminal proceedings at the ICC. Again, there are good reasons why a linguistic anthropologist, or a social scientist more generally, would develop such a keen interest in the ICC. First, there is the fact that the ICC is a novel institution, which was established only 2 decades ago. Hence, ICC judges and court officers face the task of having to get a court up and running almost from scratch. The Rome Statute, the ICC's founding treaty that contains the court's substantive and procedural law, is a document of exactly 58 pages. The accompanying rules of procedure and evidence are slightly longer, at 88 pages. Based on these 2 short texts, judges, counsels, and court officers must develop routines and practices that meet the requirement of a fair and just trial. And again, this requires negotiation, written motions, oral submissions in court, rulings and decisions issued by the trial chamber, objections, etc., etc., etc. In short, more language and more interaction. For a language and law scholar, this is a unique opportunity. Domestic criminal courts, without exception, draw on tradition, on an accepted body of established routines and interpretations. The ICC, in contrast, gives us the chance to observe a court that is still in the process of consolidating itself. Second, there is the fact that the ICC is forced to navigate a complex geopolitical landscape, and related to that, the fact that it must judge crimes committed in a political context. As a court, how are you supposed to take this political aspect into consideration? According to legal anthropologist Kamari Clark, international tribunals like the ICC have transformed international criminal justice into a spectacle. A spectacle, moreover, that favors a particular kind of perpetrator. At the ICC, the typical perpetrator role is reserved for the African warlord, the incarnation of absolute evil, who, by his own inhumane acts, has ostracized himself from the rest of humanity. What is obscured by this spectacle, Kamari Clark points out, is the involvement and responsibility of transnational actors, the geopolitical interests at play, and ultimately the fact that we ourselves may not be immune, the geopolitical interests at play and the underlying causes of political violence. What is left in the dark is the often cyclical nature of political violence, the fact that one day victims may in turn become persecutors and vice versa, and ultimately the fact that we ourselves may not be immune to the lure of discourses that dehumanize our neighbors. This, in turn, raises the question whether courts and criminal tribunals are indeed the most appropriate forum to respond to crimes that were committed in a political context. And it cannot be ruled out that this discussion about the tension between law and politics will erupt again, for example, in the context of the ongoing ICC investigation into war crimes committed in Ukraine. Thirdly and finally, the ICC deserves attention because it practices what has been called a form of distant justice. The ICC judges have to assess criminal acts committed in an unfamiliar context that is remote and far away, not only physically and geographically, but also institutionally and culturally. Therefore, we must ask ourselves, do ICC judges succeed in bridging this gap? Let us take one example. One of the trials that me and my colleagues have recently been investigating is that of Dominic Ongwen, a former commander of the Ugandan Lord's Resistance Army rebel movement. For those of you unfamiliar with the political situation in northern Uganda, between 1987 and roughly 2010, the Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA, was engaged in a protracted armed conflict with the central government of Yoweri Museveni, a conflict that caused great suffering, particularly among the Acholi population. Dominic Ongwen was one of the military commanders of the LRA, and in February last year, the ICC convicted him of 61 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity, including attacks against the civilian population, gender-based crimes such as forced marriage and sexual slavery, and the conscription of child soldiers. What makes the Ongwen trial unique is its explicit anthropological component. The defense argued that their client had committed these crimes not voluntarily but under duress, for which they referred to the numerous spirits that played a role in the rebel movement. LRA leader Joseph Kony was more than just a military commander. He was also a prophet and a spirit medium able to predict the future. Hence, to substantiate its claim that Dominic Ongwen had not been acting out of his free will, the defense called a long list of witnesses, both former LRA fighters and abductees, who told the court how the spirits speaking through Kony were actually in command of the movement, how they assisted Kony to reach other people's thoughts, and how this made it virtually impossible for LRA fighters to escape from the war. Now, how did the court respond to these witness accounts of the local context and underlying local realities? Here, something disturbing happens. In the verdict that found Ongwen guilty, the judges cite only the voices of those former rebels who rejected the LRA discourse on spirit possession, who no longer believed in it or had never believed in it at all. Much less attention was paid, however, to the equally numerous witness statements from ex-rebels who insisted that Kony was indeed possessed by powerful spirits and that he could indeed protect the future. And interestingly, the second group of fighters, those who still accept that Kony had supernatural powers, somehow appears to anticipate that outsiders will give little credibility to their belief, will give little credibility to their unorthodox beliefs. They repeatedly formulate empirical arguments to support their belief claims in what looks like a deliberate effort to convince the judges of the spirit's existence and of their hold over the living. Unfortunately, with little success. Apart from a dry remark in the verdict that some LRA members indeed believe in spirits, the judges seem to find their statements of little value in understanding the facts. If we look at it from a wider angle, however, the judge's refusal to engage with the spirit belief should come as little surprise. The manner in which the ICC deals with witnesses who believe in the supernatural is not fundamentally different from the way in which domestic courts deal with cultural others, societal outsiders, or defendants suffering from mental disorder. You do not listen to what they have to say, but you observe how they speak. You do not communicate with them, but you communicate about them. Criminal justice is grounded in the legal liberalist assumption that human beings are rational actors who bear full responsibility for their actions, and someone who fell short of this ideal is someone with whom the court cannot meaningfully engage. You are no longer a full-fledged participant, but you become an object of discourse. Now, what is disconcerting in this case is that the boundary of this self-declared community of rational actors is not defined based on the presumed inability of the witness to competently and meaningfully interact with the court, but on the basis of the fact that they hold different ontological assumptions, different beliefs about how the world operates. And if there's one point where criticism of the ICC as a colonial project makes sense, it might well be here, in the court's failure to acknowledge alternative conceptions of what the world is like. After all, these people are not insane. They just happen to, well, they just happen to believe in spirits. There is obviously much more to be said about this, and from a linguistic anthropological angle, and now I'm about to conclude, international criminal justice raises more questions than can be answered in such a short lecture. Still, I hope to have given you an impression of the critical potential of such an approach. There is a lot that can be learned about the legal process by looking at the language that is used in the courtroom, even if the insights produced by such an approach may at times be unsettling. I thank you for your attention.